Welcome to FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show. Every week we're joined by filmmakers, actors, programmers, directors, and others to sit down and chat about the state of independent cinema. Sue Friedrich is my guest. Sue is a friend of mine. I got to know her a little bit last summer at the Brooklyn Film Festival, where her film Gut Renovation had its premiere and subsequently co-won the Audience Award along with Kelly Anderson, coincidentally, for her film. Sue's film is called Gut Renovation, and it is her very personal film about living many years in a loft in Williamsburg and subsequently being tossed out. A little bit about Sue. From the onset of her career in the late 1970s, Sue has been a leading figure in avant-garde filmmaking and a pivotal force in the establishment of queer cinema. Her work has radicalized film and content by incorporating a feminist perspective and issues of lesbian identity, and by creating a remarkable and innovative synthesis of experimental narrative and documentary genres. Couldn't put it better than that. But to see her films is to truly encounter an intensely personal and unique style of filmmaking. Wanted also mention that Sue's film, Gut Renovation, which we were going to be talking about with her today, is about to enjoy a theatrical engagement at Film Forum in Lower Manhattan, starting Wednesday, March 6th, and running through the 12th. Go to filmforum.org to get details of dates and times and, tickets. You can, and I believe, I'm sure Sue will be there for many of those screenings, at least some of them. So I welcome Sue Friedrich to FilmWax Radio. Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
As I mentioned in the intro, Gut Renovation it's going to start at its theatrical engagement here in New York at Film Forum on Wednesday, the 6th of March. Are you getting excited about that?
Yes, very.
Have you shown? I know it's a ton of work preparing leading up to that day. What was the last theatrical experience you had with one of your films?
The last and only was at the Pioneer Theater, which was run by the Two Boots people. It's
right.
Now gone. In the East Village, and it was with a film called The Odds of Recovery that I made in 2002, and I had a one-week run there. But as far as I remember, it was one screening a night, and this is six screenings a day for 7 days, so there's a little bit more work, you know, to do to get people into the theater.
Right.
Yeah. But it's a great honor. I am just blown away by being at the Film Forum. Sort of. Like,
Did you know Karen Cooper over there?
No.
Did she? Is it Bruce Goldstein or is it Karen Cooper that booked this film?
Well,
how does that work?
Distributor sent the DVD to them, and we got an email back from Karen saying we love the film. So the "we" may have meant him also, but that's who we were in touch with.
So the fact that somebody says "we love your film" would be troubling to me, because I feel like, you know, you're not supposed to love your films. Maybe your sensibilities, but the film itself, it should chafe people in a sense, I feel.
I think she loved how it chafed. I mean,
okay,
she said,
well,
we love the film.
Yeah.
And then she enumerated a few of the key scenes for her, which were all ones that were a little bit, let's say, crazy, or where I was being a little bit out there, which I am in the film. And I think as a old-time New Yorker, she seemed to appreciate the kind of feelings one would have, you know, that I expressed in the film.
Right, and probably knows her audience.
Right.
At this point, I'm going to guess.
Right.
They are been around for like 40-some years now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they also went through having to move from one place that was overpriced to a new place, and I think
this
that put
is
them
right.
through a lot of paces. So
the West Houston location is their third location in those 40 years, I believe. So I remember becoming familiar with the Gut Renovation back last summer at the Brooklyn Film Festival, where I believe that's where you had your world premiere.
Yes, I did.
You and Kelly won, sort of co-won is awkward language, but you both shared the audience award.
Right.
And then, who knew, months later, you also would both be part of a series called Brooklyn Reconstructed, and I appreciate that. That was a terrific
was a great series you did, yeah.
Which is concluding, actually. As people listen to this live stream, which will be on Wednesday night at 6:30, Wednesday the 27th, I'm going to do it at 6:30 because at 7, I'm showing screening of Zipper. Nicholson's film. So I wouldn't want our interview to go on simultaneously as that. So just for those listening who aren't familiar with Gut Renovation, talk a little bit about that and about, you know, the germination and what it's about. And and then we can kind of chat about the what's happened since.
Well, I started shooting for it in early 2006 because in May of 2005, the city council approved a rezoning of Williamsburg to change it from primarily industrial in certain areas to residential. And that created a firestorm of developing. And I had lived in the neighborhood for about 17 years. And we had seen it coming, but then the rezoning really magnified the changes that had been happening. And so I wanted to document those changes because I had gone through that a bit in the East Village, nothing to the extent that of what happened in Williamsburg, but I had gone through that, and I thought I kept forgetting all the old places, so I didn't want to forget them. So I sort of started, it was an act of witnessing, and then it became an act of recording everything I could possibly find because it was so crazy what was happening, and so many people were losing their places, and so it just snowballed, and it became something where I shot, 40 hours of footage and ended up making a feature-length documentary, and it took me almost 6 years to make it because, ironically, it was a film about people being thrown out of the neighborhood, and then we lost our place, and so we spent about 2 years finding a new place and moving to it, so that interrupted the editing. But basically, it's really a sort of from the inside look at what happened to Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it comes out, I think, at just the right time, because it comes out on the heels of My Brooklyn, which has enjoyed a really huge success, I mean, relatively speaking, right, which was fairly close after the Battle for Brooklyn, having theatrical trajectory and of course the opening of the arena and everything else. So I think Gut Renovation arrives at Film Forum just at the right moment. So with time off for moving, I think it turned out to be just a good. It added.
I think when you're working on something, you always want it to get done.
Of course, you're feeling you're fighting so much.
But also things kept changing in Williamsburg, so. Just when I thought I'd recorded everything, I would go back, like let's say after we moved, I would go back with my camera and find another huge building. So, I actually could have thought, well, now I should continue for another 4 or 5 years because the building is still going on. But one does have to finish. But I think it was good to wait as long as I did. And then, as you say, to finish when I did because of, this sort of awareness now.
Certainly. Can you give like a context of what kind of growth you're talking about to people that aren't familiar with Williamsburg in terms of the sheer numbers?
Well,
really, really staggering.
Yeah. The zoning was in May of 2005. Within, I think, the first week after the rezoning, there were 130 plans on the table. The city table where, people submit plans for buildings. So there were 130 plans already ready to go before the rezoning because all the developers knew that it was going to happen. So if you think 130 buildings, all of which are, let's say, five-story buildings that have anywhere from 50 to 250 units in them, do the math. It's like many thousands of units, and that was only the beginning. So when I started going through the neighborhood with my map and my red pen and marking out all the lots that I saw being developed, all the buildings that I saw being gut renovated. In the end, I had 173. And like I said, they're still doing more of them. But we're talking about tens of thousands of new units. And if anyone has gone to Williamsburg, particularly during rush hour, or who lives there, they know what that means in terms of public transportation because there is only one train that runs on a single track to and from the city. And we moved out in, let's say, in 2007. So this was only 2 years after the rezoning. We lived in a loft with a couple of roommates who had regular jobs in town. Mm-hmm. And even in 2007, they found that when they were trying to go to work in the morning, they would have to wait for four trains because they were so crowded already. And this is now years later. I don't know how people are getting to work. So yes, the numbers of units being built, being approved by the city to be built in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, bears no relationship to what's actually available in terms of amenities and public transportation. So it's right. really crazy.
Right. And what about, like, you know, you just begin to think about what you're talking about, the concentration of apartments and homes, and then where are the schools, and
right.
where is the hospitals, and
right.
where's the infrastructure that wasn't counted in the plan, right. as far as I know, because it,
no. And one of the things that one little segment in the film shows a group of buildings on a corner that had been gut renovated, and it pans over to the fire station, and that fire station, which was on Wythe, was closed in 2003. And when it was closed, this was before the rezoning, and we were still, you know, so let's say there weren't the other 40,000 people living in the neighborhood. And even then, with it being still sort of a modest neighborhood, we were thinking, no fire station, that does not bode well for anybody living in the area who has a fire. It's mm-hmm. still closed. And
yeah.
I don't know where those people are going to, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. But yes, there are many questions about the infrastructure in the neighborhood. The only thing they've provided for are tons of bars and expensive restaurants. It's like, that's the infrastructure.
You know,
the rest of it is, you know.
Yeah.
Not there.
Something to drown your sorrows with, I suppose. if you can make it there on time, because you've had to wait for four L trains. Let's make no mistake. This is a Sue Friedrich film. This is a highly personal film. When I went to see it, to sort of just, you know, allude to what I said earlier, having seen it at the Brooklyn Film Festival, I was looking at the first 20 minutes saying, what is this? I'm so used to films like Battle for Brooklyn. There's a structure right. there that I'm sorts of filmmaking conventions. When I was waiting for this to happen, it just wasn't happening. There was somebody shouting out the window expletives at developers walking by, and, you know, watching a rock attempted to be moved for like a really, really long time. So there's a huge part of your
like
movie.
6 minutes.
That's long in a movie of 80 minutes or something.
Right.
But also, if you know Sue's films, this fits in that, I would say, in that oeuvre of the style that you have kind of made very distinctively your own.
Yeah.
It's your voice.
I really admire, let's say, Battle for Brooklyn, which had to tell such a complicated story. Well, as well as My Brooklyn, of course. Such a complicated story, and so they're dealing with tons of statistics and city documents
Maps.
And tenants' rights groups doing
right.
meetings, and unbelievable the kind of stuff they collected and then put in order, you know, to tell a good story
right.
in both cases. And so I could have done something like that, and somebody else might,
mm-hmm.
but it's true that that's not the sort of film that I usually make or have ever made. And I suppose I think of this a little more like an essay film, like, let's say, what somebody like Agnes Varda or Chris Marker might do, where they're looking at the real world, they're going into situations and filming them, but they're sort of putting it together to maybe talk about a larger picture, to say, okay, this is one example of something, like, let's say, Agnes Varda in The Gleaners and I talking about the act of gleaning. But she takes it outside of one situation so that you can sort of contemplate its meaning in a larger way. And so there's a little bit of that in how I thought about making the film. And also, I'm not a sociologist. I'm not an activist filmmaker. And so it isn't in my nature to pull together a lot of documents and present a lot of charts and graphs. And I really love seeing that in other films, but that's not natural to me.
Right.
And so I think there are other things that I can do that serve a different purpose and sort of a parallel purpose to their films. For example, The Rock. So there we were, living in our place, and across the street, they had torn down a fantastic old building and unearthed a gigantic, you know, one of the bedrock rocks of New York, and sort of the size of this recording studio. And I put my camera on a tripod because I had the feeling this was going to pose a problem for them. And then over the course of many days, mm-hmm. I recorded their various efforts to get rid of this rock. When I was putting it together in the film, I then set it to a Vivaldi piece, because I thought that added a little bit of humor to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
But it did seem to me, you know, it was sort of a metaphor. Like, here are all these people in the neighborhood who have tried so hard to keep this from happening, who have tried to hold on to their houses. And here's this rock also saying, no, this is where I belong.
Mm-hmm.
And then these guys, and I have nothing against construction workers. It's a good job. I do a lot of construction myself. But here are these people whose job it is to get this thing out of here so new things can come in. And this rock is like, like, I am not leaving.
Yeah.
But of course, they did succeed in the end, but at least
well, when you call in North Korea to take care of it, yeah, no, but it's true. And you use a lot of these kinds of devices. You mentioned the music, the Vivaldi piece, and then throughout also there are snide intertitles,
right.
Very tongue-in-cheek. I use these terms with love, so, you know, to call you snide is not my objective, but, you know, I guess it's surprising to me to see somebody who is hostile. It's reactive, but it's... You're showing your hostility, I think, which is a brave thing to do on film. I don't think a lot of people will get that. They're like, you know, a lot of people... Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, do people see it and gut renovation and say, well, what's wrong with putting in nice new buildings for a lot of people?
Well, of course, people make that case. But I want to... Just to go back to the other question of showing anger.
Yeah, please do.
And some people could say, well, of course, you know, that's the sort of thing that Michael Moore does. So we're sort of familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
But there might be a slightly different... quality to this, because maybe it's a little more personal. I make myself a little more vulnerable because I also sometimes ridicule myself for that anger, and I don't think Michael Moore would ever criticize himself for being aggressive towards his subjects. But then I was just at the Berlin Film Festival, and after one of the screenings, this guy came out and said, you know, I'm just really curious about this anger. Why would you show so much anger? Because it seems like you did feel very angry. And I said, well, what I knew from living there was that there were so many people who were angry, as well as sad. So I felt that when I was doing that, there were hundreds of people behind me, you know,
yes.
Or I was yelling for them or on behalf of them, right? And he kept pressing me on it. And I said, well, do you think there's something wrong with anger? And then, lo and behold, he said, no, the exact same thing is happening to me. This is happening a lot in Berlin.
I guess I should note down Berlin Reconstructed. Yeah.
He said, the exact same thing is happening to me, and I'm terribly angry, and I don't know what to do with my anger. So, you know, he started out making it seem as if there was something really sort of weird and unseemly about my anger. And then in the end, he's saying, like, you know, thank you, because I'm
you
really
speak,
angry
I'm one
also.
Of those people standing behind you.
And
yeah.
I think people who are thrown out of their homes are angry.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to be polite when this happens? No, I don't think so. We should say that alongside the anger is a lot of humor. I mean, my partner was the co-writer, and I think she injected a lot of necessary humor to the film. So, you know, I don't want people to think it's just me ranting and raving through the whole thing, because there are...
And I struggled with calling it polemical. It sort of is polemical on some level, but you know what I mean? But in a positive way, mostly you hear like, oh, I don't want to go to a film that's telling me what to, you know, think, that has this agenda behind it that I'm supposed to just sort of swallow. But in a way, you are asking people to accept your agenda, because it's an agenda that's, you're not part of some enormous majority. You're part of a minority.
Right. But also, I mean, I think it's partly that I thought I'm willing and able to ride around on my bike with my camera and go to the showing parties when they were selling these spaces. And I could collect all that and show it to people who wouldn't have, you know, wouldn't have lived there, wouldn't have gone to the trouble. And so it's sort of a peek sort of behind those closed doors about what was going on. And so it's, I don't think it's so much saying, you know, look, this is what happened, but like, wow, did you guys know this was happening? Because this was really crazy. And even I know for people who lived in the neighborhood who saw the film, they said, God, I can't believe those, you know, sales parties, or I can't believe the statistics. Or I almost felt like I was providing a service for people to see this or experience this, you know, who couldn't have done it themselves.
Let's take a drive around the neighborhood. And you point out a couple of things that kind of stand out in your memory.
Okay.
This is Adam Shartoff, host of FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show, Wednesday night, 6:30 to 7:30 on bboxradio.com.
I thought I would, like, drive around and just
point
start sort of at the bottom of Kent.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I mean, there's building all through the neighborhood, but Kent really has been totally transformed. So it sort of started with Schaefer Landing and the Gretsch Building below the bridge, but I didn't really deal with anything below the bridge in the film. So above, I mean, one of the first ones is the Cass Gilbert Building, which is a really beautiful building. And this person wants to go past. Okay. So maybe I should pull over. And it's interesting because one of the... I think it was David Yaski.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the local council members was very supportive of the Cass Gilbert building being taken over by a developer. And he said, oh, it's just a big white box. And if you see images of this building, it's not a big white box. It's this beautiful 19th century building.
Yeah.
Which now is a big white box because they just filled it full of condos. But then beyond those beyond that building is Northside Piers and the Edge. And there's even a third tower that's going to go up. In the film, Northside Piers plays a part because somebody I know who had a really wonderful small loft in the neighborhood was thrown out when a new buyer came in, and she has a daughter, and she's a painter, so she needed a studio, and she was really freaking out because she had no idea where she was going to go. And she applied for affordable housing space in Northside Piers, and it's really awful. I've been to her apartment, and it's really horrible. But it's also done so that, you know, you have this low, ugly building at the base of this tall glass and steel condo.
Right.
And they have different entrances, so the people who are in the luxury condo units enter in a fancy lobby,
right,
and they have all the amenities, and the people who are in the affordable housing get access to
There's not a lock on the door, and
yeah, right.
There's a stairwell, but that's so tacky. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like their punishment at the same time. It's like, we're not letting you forget you're the part which
that's
segment
right.
you belong to,
that's
by the
right.
way. So,
yeah.
Nice bike paths, by the way, we'll say here. I mean, these are very.
That's
this
true.
This is a long thoroughfare of bike lane here.
And what I can do is if I drive
careful,
up,
this guy.
What we're going to. And it's. Uh-huh. There's one building, like on the riverside, an older building. There were a few others back in the day. They were all torn mm-hmm. down, but there is one old building on the corner that is still inhabited by, you know, old timers. But it's also where NAG has their office, and that's they started out as Neighbors Against Garbage way back. I mean, when we first moved into the neighborhood and. In the late 80s, early 90s, they were around. But now they've changed their name to... I mean, it's still NAG, but it's Neighbors Allied for Good Growth. And what they've been trying to
Two
do...
Two G's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What they've been trying to do is hold the city's feet to the fire because there were a lot of promises in the rezoning for park land and, you know, various amenities for the neighborhood, which have not been met. They've been, you know, very quick to let all the developers... put up their buildings, but these other things they have not really been doing, and so NAG has been working really hard to, you know, keep those promises alive and get those things done. And they're actually going to be at the screening. I'm doing.
That's why I was going to ask about that.
Right, I'm doing four Q&As after screenings, and the one on Friday at 6:15.
The eighth of March.
Ryan Cronin and Ward Dennis, who are the you know, main people at NAG will be at that Q&A at the 6:15 show to talk about what's going on in Williamsburg.
We'll put a link up to their website as well on this our show page here. So as we're finishing here, let's drive over towards. I want to see your block, your old block, and of course where the rock was. That whole scene. That's if we can head over there.
We were on North 11th between Barry and Wythe, and in fact, even here there was a place on the corner called Colonial Glass, and they've been there since, and I'm not remembering, you know, 1928 or something. And it was just one of the very typical industries, and one of the typical industries that were, you know, there were so many of them in Williamsburg, and they seemed very solid. I mean, I'd gotten some glass cut for a table just, you know, a year or two before, and they really looked like they were thriving. And, of course, you know, I went by... I can't remember now when it was, some months back or whatever, and they're gone also. You know, it's like one after the other, and there's a long sequence in the film set to this music where I show as many industries as possible, you know, during this three-minute segment. And now when I watch the film, I can count off gone, 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 gone. You know, some are still there, but a lot are gone. So anyway, Colonial Glass is gone. And so then, yes, and our building, which has now been empty ever since we left. So we left 3.5 years ago. And it's connected to the side and the 10th Street side, different structures, but all owned by the same person. And those are still filled with some small industries in the side building. And then they're doing a gut reno of mm-hmm. the 10th Street side. And I heard recently they're going to put 64 units into this building, which okay. used to have, I don't know, 12 units or something. Right. But our side, the three stories empty. Of our sort of landmarked 1900s building has been empty ever since. It was sold for $16.5 million to some brokers from Corcoran, and they now have a sign up that says commercial short-term lease, you know, available, mm-hmm. but they have not leased it to anybody, so I don't know what they're doing with it. And when you see it, you know, even like on a rainy day, one of the windows, in fact, that was in my studio, mm. is sort of half open. It's the reason the building was landmarked was because it's one of the last buildings in New York that has casement windows, which swivel open.
Yes.
And and one of them just sits open, and the rain pours in, and the snow comes in,
wow.
and obviously they don't give a shit.
And maybe birds.
Yes, more birds.
Yeah, as we see at the start of the film.
Right.
Thank you, Sue, for giving me a little tour.
Sure.
Of the Berg.
Well, it's always interesting to go back and see what's up.
Well, it
must
be bittersweet.
Yeah.
More bitter at this point, but. Again, it's gut renovation. It will be at the Film Forum from March the 6th through the 12th.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Sue.
Well, thank you, Adam.